Okay. Welcome, everyone. Good to see you. So we've got today a double thing. It's the first time we're doing it like this. We've got people in the real and people on Zoom. So I hope that'll work. Apologies to both those here and on Zoom that this air conditioning makes an unbelievable racket. We davened here on Shabbos. Someone said it's to remind us about what international travel sounds like. But it's better, I think, to be cool than to... So we'll just have to strain a little bit. But hope everyone on Zoom can listen, can hear, and everything's good. So we doing this one-off shiur in the first session of the summer learning program. I just want to mention in the beginning before we start that today's learning, the whole summer learning program, all the shiurim, are in memory of Leah Bat Baruch HaKohen. That's Mordechai Aaron's mother, whose yahrzeit is today. I wish her that the family should have Arichas Yomim, long life, and only good things, and that the Neshama should have an Aliyah. So today's talk is on guilt, shame, and regrets. And the question is, all bad or sometimes good? I did give part of this discussion a few months ago on Thursday morning. So if you were there on Zoom, it's a bit of a revision, but it's an important topic. So it's a personal growth idea that I've been sort of looking at. I've looked at it a few times, but I looked at it from a bit of a different perspective over the last few months. And what I'm going to share with you today, in part, is based on the works of Edith Eger in her second book called The Gift. Two great books, The Choice and The Gift. And also some of the works that I studied recently on by Dr. David Polkowitz, who is a leading psychologist in a Torah scholar and a leading psychologist in America, a very, very famous person. I'm basing it in part on the stuff that he writes. Okay, so we talk about guilt, shame, or regrets. So the question is, what are the connotations? Like, shame a positive thing, a negative thing? In other words, what do you feel sort of when you see these words, right? Anyone?
Negative words,
generally speaking, right. However, we'll see later that it really depends on... Hi. You want to just grab some chairs over here? It depends on how you use the terms. That's the truth. And also, even in some psychological literature, you'll see it depends who's writing it, and it depends what they mean. Oh, sorry about that. I'm going to have to... Give me 1 second, sorry. Oh, no, all good. It depends what they mean. It depends who's writing it. It all depends, right? So we're gonna explore it a little bit. But before we explore it, I think out of the three words, regrets, guilt, and shame, probably regrets has the least negative connotation, because regret can sometimes be a good thing. Guilt, we always look at as a negative thing, and shame for sure, right? But is it? Is shame such a negative thing necessarily? So what I want to do is I want to go through with you things we've talked about before, but I want to share with you a very, very important sort of introduction, right, to understand this. Kabbalistically, we know that we are made up of 10 powers, called the 10 powers of the soul, which also has a division between intellect and emotion. Or perhaps if you want to divide it sort of even more, you could say it's intellect, emotion, and behavior, which we normally call Kabbalistically the three powers of intellect, the six powers of emotion, and malchut, which is sort of implementation and putting it into practice. So let's say we have six emotional powers, right? And then after six emotional powers that we have, every other emotion that we know about, every emotion that you read about or you think about, in other words, if you take the English dictionary and you go through a list of words that represent emotion, they're always a derivative, an extension, an extrapolation of one of these six, right? I'll give you an example. So, you talk about being love, for example. That's one emotion, right? Compassion is another emotion, different to love. tolerance is another sort of emotion, right? They all come from one of these six. They all come from chesed, right? So chesed is the kindness, the giving, the love, etc., etc. Then you have things like aggression, or self-control, or discipline, or being loyal, or organized, all these things. Not only emotions, even behaviors, they're all rooted in one of these things. They're all rooted in what we call gevurah. So we talk about the six midot, the six emotional powers that God created us with. They all, these are the six general ones, the six categories, the six headings, so to speak, right? Now, there is a principle in Judaism, talked about a lot in Kabbalah, that any emotion that a person is created with, the exception of two, and I'll explain what they are in a minute, any emotion that we have can either be good or bad, right? Which, of course, you can see is leading to our discussion, because there are some emotions which we automatically think, oh, that's a good thing. There are some which you automatically think is a bad thing, but it's not true. Yeah, some lean themselves more towards good, some lean towards bad, but it's actually not correct to say, because every emotion that God created us with is there for a purpose. So let's give an example. Love. Is love always good? No. You can love the wrong thing, right? Or you can love badly. You can have selfish love rather than selfless love, right? So love is always, the connotation is a good thing, but it's not always a good thing. Depends how it's expressed, depends how it's done, depends how it's implemented, how it's expressed and so on, right? When we talk about gvura, so normally gvura is always, connotation is always negative, like judgment or intolerance or aggression, hate, all these things come from gvura. They're not always bad. A person never hates, that's a problem. You've got to hate evil, for example, right? Discipline is a good thing. Self-control is a good thing. Also comes from gvura, right? So every emotion can be good or bad. The exception to it is, which the Rambam already talks about, the two exceptions is arrogance and rage, right? Rage is never considered good because, by definition, rage is complete loss of control. Number one. And number two, rage, by definition, has its roots in arrogance. Why do you lose control of someone else? Because who do you think you are to step on my toes? I lose my temper, right? And arrogance is the other one, the second one, that is never good. Why is ego never good? Right? Now, don't confuse ego with a healthy self-perception or a healthy perception of self. That's not ego, right? Ego means a feeling of superiority in other people. In fact, ego can be, as we've talked about many times, ego can be rooted in a deep insecurity, because I'm so insecure about myself, so therefore I'm protective of myself the entire time, and therefore I have this need to show that I'm better than other people. So arrogance is always bad. Why is arrogance always bad? And the Gemara talks about this, and the Talmud talks about it, and the Maimonides discusses it, that arrogance is something we all have it, by the way, we all have some level of ego, but we have to try to avoid it, try to eliminate it, right? In other words, every other emotion that we have, we shouldn't try to eliminate ultimately. We have to control it, put it under control for a moment, but then we need to try and channel it to positive, to something good. But arrogance is something we need to try and eliminate. Why is that? Because arrogance is actually the root of the negative expression of all the other emotions. You follow? In other words, there's good jealousy and bad jealousy, for example, which you're not going to go into today. That's a separate discussion, right? One difference between good jealousy and bad jealousy is good jealousy comes from arrogance. That I'm better than you, so I'm jealous if you have something I don't have. Good jealousy is about spiritual things, and it's about aspiration, and it's about wanting something that someone else has in a good way, but without wanting them not to have it, right? So there's no ego involved. So that's good. So ego is like the driver. So the analogy that we're often given is this, right? If you have a machine, any machine, a lot of machines can be used for good, used for bad. If you have a machine that's very powerful, an electric saw, a car, anything like that, it depends. Right? That can be very, very good. They can be used to transport. They can be used to take you places. They can be used for amazing things. They can also be used in a destructive context. If someone is drunk driving, they can have an accident and kill someone, God forbid, right? So it all depends on what? It depends on the driver. The machine is neither here nor here. The machine is potentially good or potentially bad. The driver is what counts, right? So arrogance is the driver of all negative expression of emotion. One of the drivers. That's what has to be eliminated. So, with the exception, is that clear? Am I making sense? Yeah. So, with the exception of arrogance and rage, right? Every other midah, every other emotion, actually has a good side and a bad side. If that's the case, let's go back to regret, guilt, and shame. Although they have negative emotion, negative connotations, but they have a positive side, which we have to try and explore. But before we explore that, let's put it in a general sense. The general way to know if something is good or bad, right, from a Jewish point of view, from a spiritual perspective, is the following. When something is negative, it has a few properties. So when a person experiences an emotion, might be guilt, might be sadness, whatever the case is, if it paralyzes the person spiritually, in other words, if it paralyzes the person and blocks them from growth, which a lot of negative emotions do, right? Resentment, for example, often doesn't let you grow, doesn't let you break through, doesn't let you move and move on and so on. It's a very trapping type of thing. That's always a negative expression. An emotion that's used for an escape, right? An escape, not to have to deal with something, is negative. So sometimes grief, for example, is an unbelievable emotion. It's an important emotion. Necessary if it's not done in excess. When it's done excessively, it becomes a problem, and then it becomes an escape. Rather than have to move on and deal with it, it becomes a negative thing, right? A negative emotion is often selfish. It means it's self-centered. It's for my own personal gain. It's for pleasure-seeking. It's for my own short-term benefit rather than long-term vision, so to speak, right? So all these are sort of properties that will indicate to you if the emotion you're experiencing is negative or positive, right? So if a person's experiencing something and the, as I say in Yiddish, the tachlis is, what is it bringing to, right? Are you growing from it? Is it moving you? Is it selfless or selfish? Is it just for your short-term gain, or is it for long-term vision and goal and value system, right? That's the question to ask. Because a positive expression of an emotion, even an emotion that we might think is somewhat negative, but a positive expression would be if it brings growth, if it facilitates growth, right? If it enhances your higher values, if it's selfless rather than selfish, if actually it's enhancing your self-control rather than killing your self-control. And it's something that brings meaning and purpose. So that's kind of the difference. Those two things are the differences between if something is positive or something is negative. So let's explore then, in that context, let's explore regrets, guilt, and shame. So in Edith Eger's book, for example, she talks about guilt. She has a book called The Gift where she talks about, I think, the 14 or 11, 12 prisons of the mind. And one chapter that she calls there is the prison of guilt and shame, right? She doesn't talk about regrets, because actually she calls it something else and she calls it a good thing, but the prison of guilt and shame. So in the context that she's talking about guilt in a negative sense and shame for sure in a negative sense, right? And I'll just read to you something that she said that's very beautiful. She says, does everyone know who Edith Eger is, by the way? No, oh, sorry, I should. She's becoming quite a famous personality now. So she's 93 at the moment. She's still practicing as a psychologist, a therapist. And she's a Holocaust survivor. She only graduated, I think, in her 50s. And the most incredibly happy and the most amazing woman. And when she was almost 90, she wrote her first book called The Choice. And I mean, she has a whole long, amazing story of growth and self-discovery and really good values. And then I think at 92, she wrote a second book, which just came out recently, called The Gift, right? So it's important to know that information because the context is very important. So she says the following. She says, "It took me decades to forgive myself for surviving," as very often happens. She says, "I graduated from college in 1969. Sorry, I was 42 years old, a mother of three, an immigrant. I had required significant courage and resources to learn English and return to school, and I was graduating with honors." And then she says, "But I didn't go to my graduation ceremony. I was too ashamed." Obviously, negative shame, right? "Like many survivors, in the years after the war, I'd grappled with crippling guilt. It had been 24 years since my sister Magda and I were liberated, but I still couldn't understand why I had lived with my parents and grandparents, why I had lived when my parents and grandparents and 6 million others had perished." And so on, right? And she says, "Guilt is when you blame yourself, when you believe something is your fault. It is important to separate guilt from remorse." Okay, so she used the word remorse. We can use the word regret maybe, right? And she says, remorse is a good thing sometimes. Why? Because remorse is an appropriate response to a harmful mistake we've made or a wrong we've committed. It's more akin to grief. It means accepting that the past is the past and it cannot be undone. And allowing yourself to feel sad about it, I can feel remorse and recognize all that I lived through and the choices that I've made have brought me to today. Remorse is in the present and it can coexist with forgiveness and freedom, but guilt keeps you stuck. Okay, now, so let's just take it there for a second, right? So she's already alluded to the fact, although she says guilt is a negative thing, which most time it is, but remorse, or what we call regret, is actually a good thing. Now, it's not a good thing in excess, but it's a good thing, it depends what you're doing. So we know, for example, that Maimonides talks about the concept of tshuva, right? Tshuva essentially is the ability that God has given us to always right a wrong, to always repent, to always return, and to always grow. Oh, wow. My Zoom thing just completely disconnected. I wonder why. Wait, okay. It's connecting again, I don't know, we'll see what happens. Okay. What if it's the... Oh, it's all working. Happens. Anyway, so when a person when a person grows, right? Part of growth, part of tshuva, part of the idea of returning is to learn from failure. It's to understand that we make mistakes. God designed us imperfectly. He designed us to make mistakes. He designed us to learn from the mistakes and then to improve in the future, right? That's the essence of what tshuva is, right? However, one can only do that if... Here we are. One second, let me just... I'm back on. I'm not sure if anyone else is. Also muted for some reason. Second. Oh. Sorry about that. I hope everyone's back on now. Alright. Well, for the best. Sorry, there was something with the those on Zoom. There was something with the Zoom, I'm not sure why. I hope everyone's back on. Okay. So we can only grow, right? A critical part of growth is remorse. That's what the Rambam tells us. When the Rambam talks about tshuva, he says the first step of tshuva is charata, which literally means regret, right? Meaning, what is charata? So it means not just regret. It actually means more than that. It actually means, and I think charata is actually the form of healthy guilt. It means to feel intensely uncomfortable of where I am. Right, it's a part of the process, because if you don't feel uncomfortable where you are, then you won't move from where you are. And there's no need to move into something different. Okay, so growth comes from a feeling of discomfort of where I am. In other words, I know where I am. I know that I made a mistake. I feel uncomfortable about the mistake. I have to feel uncomfortable about the mistake. Otherwise, why would I do anything about it? If I'm okay with the mistake I made. Now, that's, you have to be careful how we understand that statement, okay? In other words, I have to be generally okay with failure, because that's who I am, that's what a human being is. But I have to be specifically, at least for a short amount of time, I need to feel not okay about the mistake that I've made so that I can move. So let's give you an example, right? I made a mistake and I did something I shouldn't do, either between me and someone else or between me and God. So I insulted someone yesterday, let's say, right? It's a mistake. If I don't feel bad about it, I'm not going to do anything about it. Or if I lose my temper a lot. If I don't feel bad about losing my temper, then there's no reason to address it. I've had this experience with people who tell me, just accept me, this is who I am. That's like, I am who I am, I'm an angry person, you don't like me, you don't have to talk to me, and that's the end of the story. Okay, so that's okay for me, I don't have to talk to the person, but for the person it means they will never grow, they're completely stuck. Stuck people are people who are trapped in their own prison. Part of that prison is that they never ever feel uncomfortable with what they've done. Now, so if that's the case, why do we say that regret and guilt are negative things? See, here's the key. So first of all, let me just make the distinction between regret and guilt. I think when we talk about growth in the context of Jewish writings, it's not enough just to regret what we've done. We actually have to feel uncomfortable. There is a concept of guilt. However, here comes the key. and the difference between healthy guilt and non-healthy guilt, right? Or negative guilt. Because when we talk about guilt, we normally think about it as a paralyzing emotion. And people are. There are lots of people that are completely paralyzed in guilt and never move forward. It comes, in other words, that's, remember what I said before, it all depends what it's doing, right? So, a very, very famous idea, is an idea that is brought down in the book of Tanya, where he talks about guilt. He doesn't call it guilt, but he calls it merirut, which literally translates means feeling bitter, right? And he calls it merirut. He says it's a difference between merirut and atzvut, bitterness or sadness. He says sadness is a very, very bad thing. Depression with a small d, I mean, right? You're just feeling flat and a bad mood and down, and that doesn't get you anywhere. However, there's a concept called merirut, which is good. And he says, what is that? Merirut is exactly how, it's exactly what we've just been describing. It says when someone sits down, reflects, makes what we call in Hebrew a cheshbon, reflects on what they've been doing, comes to the conclusion that they're not where they should be, and for a period of time, like on Yom Kippur, or like it says on every night when you say Shema and you reflect on the day, and you have this intense feeling discomfort of things that I might have done that day, you also feel good about the things you've done well, which is also important, right? That's a separate discussion. And then you make a decision that tomorrow I'm going to try and fix it, right? Now, that decision comes from a very, very healthy perspective. Comes from a healthy perspective is that, number one, I'm not defined by my mistakes. I feel uncomfortable by my mistakes, but I'm not defined by them. God has given me the possibility to fail, and I'm okay with that. But he wants me to feel uncomfortable with this. I should take responsibility, and he's given me the gift of being able always, that it's never too late. No matter how many times I repeat the mistake, I can always fix it. I can always do tshuva. So that's number one. Number two, and this is the real important concept of when it's negative guilt or when it's positive guilt, right? And he says an amazing thing. He says that guilt, it depends who's controlling who. Guilt is good, not only good, critical and important for growth, when you control it. Meaning, it doesn't control you, you control it. That means if a person can actually, it sounds almost ridiculous, but this is the key. You can actually set aside time to feel guilty, and then get rid of it when you're done. In other words, like this. The way I like to always put it, I want to write an article on this called "It's the guest that's got to go." It's like a guest, right? You decide when the guest is invited. You decide when you tell them it's enough, right? Well, sometimes it's hard, but you know, you say, "I'm really sorry, I got to go now," right? And that's what guilt is. Guilt is I decide. In other words, I know that it's an important emotion to experience, because what it does, the merirut concept that he talks about there in Tanya, creates a sense of urgency. That's why it's important. In other words, if this will be wrong yesterday, I should try and fix it, but there's no urgency there. Urgency is created. So like, for example, we know that part of Yom Kippur process, I'm just using Yom Kippur because I think some people relate to it, it's not just Yom Kippur, right? Is that we have Elul, we have a month to reflect, and part of the result of that reflection should lead to a certain amount of healthy guilt. But for example, in the structure of Tishrei, I'm just using it as a model, we have Yom Kippur, we certainly do feel both joy and guilt, but there's a part of Yom Kippur, let's say, that we do have a sort of sense of urgency that I'm sorry and I regret this and we need to change and we need to make a resolution for the coming year and so on and so forth. But then as soon as Yom Kippur finishes, we break into song and now it's Sukkot, we have to be happy, right? Because guilt is something that I control. In other words, I invite it as part of the process and journey of my thinking to kickstart a sense of urgency in my journey of growth, but I also let go of it when I've made that resolution to grow. So I invite it in to reflect and to realize that I'm uncomfortable, to have this intense feeling of discomfort by doing the wrong thing, and then I don't define myself by the wrong thing. On the contrary, what the guilt has done, that's what I said before, what the guilt has done is it's facilitated growth. Rather than trap me, it's actually urging me to grow. It's urging me to move on, because it's in that context that I've let it become part of me. Just to understand that where I am is uncomfortable, but with the belief, number one, with the ability to banish the feeling now, and also with the belief that God allows me there not to be defined by it and to move on, right? That's the difference between good regret, good guilt, and bad regret and bad guilt. Just to use the words of Rabbi Sachs, he has an article where he talks about the culture of guilt and the culture of shame. Now, again, as I said before, it all depends what you're reading to know what they're referring to. So in that article, it's referring to guilt as a good thing and shame as a bad thing, right? There is good shame too, which we'll get to, but generally shame is a bad thing, right? So he says like this, he says, I'll read it to you, it's a very beautiful paragraph. He says, the biggest difference is that in shame cultures, right, where people have culture of shame, if we're caught doing wrong, there's a stain on our character that only time can erase. In other words, shame means like, I'm embarrassed because I'm a failure, right? So cultures that have a culture of shame means when they do something wrong, they're always petrified to get caught, because if they get caught, it means their reputation is ruined, and they ruined, and only time, when everyone forgets about it, it'll be okay, right? But he says, but guilt cultures make a sharp distinction between the doer and the deed, the sinner and the sin. That's why guilt cultures focus on atonement and repentance, apology and forgiveness. The act was wrong, but on our character, there's no indelible stain, right? Is that what we were talking about before? In other words, I have the guilt just to know that I have to take responsibility for it, but it doesn't define who I am. In shame cultures, he says, if you've done wrong, the first rule is don't be found out. If you are, then bluff your way through. Only admit when every other alternative has failed, because you'll be disgraced for a very long time indeed. That's why shame is a bad thing, because you're defined by yourself by your wrongdoing. Whereas guilt, the way he describes it, which is what we talked about before, is you don't define yourself, you just feel uncomfortable, you take responsibility, and it facilitates growth. Right? That's the difference. Okay. So let's have a look at shame now. Okay. Now, shame generally has a very, very bad connotation. We know this also because if you look in the Gemara, if you look in the Talmud, you can know how terrible it is to inflict shame on another person, right? To embarrass another person, to cause them to have shame, right? We'll talk about this before if we have time, but a little bit later. We know that the Talmud says that if you humiliate someone, particularly in public, it's like murder, right? It's like complete humiliation. It's compared to murder. There's a very fascinating thing in the Talmud that in Chumash actually, that you know in the Torah context when you damage someone, you injure someone, there's a bunch of different damages that one needs to pay. That's how the structure works legally, right? Not all of them apply all the time, but it could be that if you attack someone, you injure them, let's say in public or whatever the case is, there's five types of damages that you're supposed to pay. For example, you're supposed to pay for medical bills. If someone is hurt, their medical bills, you have to pay for that. You have to compensate them for the loss of work. So let's say if you hurt someone and you incapacitated them for a while, time being, whatever the case is, you gotta pay them compensation for the loss of work, right? You gotta pay them for the actual pain that they receive, for the actual injury that they receive, whatever the case is. And there's different ways you work it out. One of the things that Torah mandates you have to pay if you hurt someone is something called boshet. Boshet means money, a fine for embarrassing the person. It's a fine for humiliation, right? Part of the damages. Of course, in the Gemara, there's a whole concept of how you work out that price and how you do it. Okay. But there's a concept that one is supposed to pay someone for embarrassing them. Part of the damages, right? Because it's a terrible thing to inflict humiliation on someone else. Is a terrible, terrible thing. Now, on the other hand, so let's take the Hebrew word for shame. Right? The Hebrew word for shame is busha. Right? Busha means shame, embarrassment. To be mit mevayesh someone means to humiliate someone. Mitbayesh means to become embarrassed, right? So the funny thing is that this term busha, which also is synonymous with shy, by the way, right? Like shy, a person who's very, very shy, very bashful. It's called a baishan, which is also another reason why it's got a negative thing. The Pirkei Avot, Ethics of the Fathers, tells us, Lo ha baishan lomed. If someone is shy and bashful, they won't be able to ask. They won't be able to learn because you can't ask questions, right? Someone that sits by Rosh Hashiva for a shiur for years on end and never asks a question won't learn, right? You'll never know when he understands. He doesn't understand whether he's got a question or not. That's right. So it's a problem. Having said that, we find tremendously positive things said about shame. Which is completely opposite of what we just said, right? One of them is a famous Chazal that tells us that the Jewish people have three innate qualities. There are three qualities that a person has which is innately Jewish. meaning it's a brand mark of Jewishness. What is that? Domlei chasadim, to do acts of kindness, tzedakah, giving charity, generosity. I mean, not that other people can't be, but it's if you want to know, if you're a Jew and you want to know what makes me Jewish, generosity, right? Rachmanim, to be compassionate, and Baishanim, to have busha. It's hard to translate. Baishanim, what does it mean? Shy people, no. Shyness is not necessarily a good thing. Sorry? Meek? Why is meek good? Right? So I don't know, we have to... Sorry? So interesting, it doesn't say humility. It actually doesn't say humility. It says, because that, yeah, it would have said anava. And you're right, humility is an incredible trait. It's certainly linked, you'll see later, it's linked, definitely linked to humility, but it's not actually humility. So what is it? Right. Another thing, there's a Gemara which says that shame, busha, may be lidei yirei chet. Shame, translated literally, brings the fear of sin. All right. Now, it's not obviously not talking about the shame because you're scared what people are going to say. Like I'm embarrassed to, I'm embarrassed to eat non-kosher because I'm worried what people will say, because that's a negative thing. That's what Rabbi Sachs is pointing out. Because then your whole living is about not getting caught. That's not a good thing, right? I mean, to a point, it's a good thing. When people help each other, that's good. But that can't be what defines my, right? So what type of shame are we talking about, right? So let me just quote for you Rabbi Pelkovitz brings in his book. There's a 14th century book of Musar, I guess you can call it, called Orchot Tzadikim, right? 14th century master of ethics, anonymous. We actually don't know who he was. We don't know the name of the author, but it's a very famous work. It was an accepted work amongst Klal Yisrael, and he has a chapter on jealousy, a chapter on this, a chapter on that. And he has a chapter on good traits and bad traits, all kinds of things, and he has a chapter on busha, right? And he says the following. He says that I'm going to read it to you. He says the trait of shame is a great fence and an iron barrier against all transgression. Therefore, one should make every effort to conduct himself in accordance with this noble trait and employ wisdom in cultivating it until it is implanted in our soul. He should enthrone it above all his impulses and regard it as more important than other traits. For through it, he will attain most of the virtues and guards himself against unseemly traits. So he pretty much glorifies the concept of busha. So what is it? What is the shame? So let's try and unpack this a little bit. See, the reason why shame normally is considered a terrible thing, a negative thing, because when we think of the word shame, right, we think of a few things. We think either of being embarrassed by other people, right? Or we think of a fear of being embarrassed, right? So why you get up and you give a talk in public and there's, you know, the people who will always ask questions, the people that will never, you'll never catch them dead raising their hand and asking a question. Why? They don't have a question, they're not intelligent, of course they are. There's just some people that are just so scared because, God forbid, my question should be a stupid question and someone might laugh, right? Now we know that's really a negative thing, it's a very bad thing, right? The person who pushes themselves more than anyone else talking is always dominating the discussion. That's a bad thing. But the person who can never assert themselves to ask a question, that's a terrible thing. It's an insecurity, right? It's a lack of self-esteem. It's not a good thing, right? Because what shame normally means, that shame, when we talk about shame, we're always talking about shame that is connected with being defined by the perception of other people. Either I said something and I really embarrassed myself and I'm so embarrassed now because, like, to me the worst thing is other people should feel bad about me, right? Or I'm scared of that happening, right? So someone who's painfully shy, for example, might, because they're very insecure, that's an insecurity. It's connected with the perception of other people. Dr. Pelkus brings a very fascinating thing. He says that researchers, psychological researchers, talk about where we educate children, And sometimes people are educated in a way that there's something that he calls, it's a nice expression called impression management. Right? In other words, you manage your life by the impression you make, right? So you're always doing something to make a good impression or bad, or you're worried about making a bad impression. And he says the interesting thing that apparently they researched this, that kids who are brought up always to be good or not be good, always solely based on what other people are going to think, end up misbehaving. They get creative at how to misbehave and not get caught. Right? It's never ingrained. It's never ingrained. So that's why, now, I just should pause here for a second and say that it doesn't mean that we should never care about other people's impression. The Pirkei Avot is very clear about this. We are responsible for other people. We need to consider other people. And therefore, the Pirkei Avot tells us that a good way to behave is to do something which is noble, but also noble in the eyes of other people, because we do. We're supposed to make morality attractive. We're supposed to get on with other people. We're supposed to help other people think good of us and not ill of us. And so that's true. But that shouldn't be our focus. That shouldn't be how we define ourselves, right? So therefore, shame is normally a bad thing. It's normally a negative thing, because it's all about me versus the outside world, right? Now, we've talked about this before, that generally speaking, when we live our lives by what I call an outside-in model, it's never good. In other words, the way we should live our lives, and this is another very big discussion, but the way we live our lives is we start from inside. We start from who we are. We start from what our value system is, right? And that's how we live, and then we consider the outside. If our whole definition, if the way we define ourselves has got to do with what happens on the outside, the way the world looks at it, the perception of others, the perception of the public, even the perception of myself externally in terms of my successes and failures and so on, but I don't actually understand my inherent intrinsic value, that's always a bad way to live. And that's part of what shame is. Shame is negative because it's always about obsession about what I'm going to look like to the outside. However, that's not good shame. There is a thing called good shame. And this is what the Torah is talking about. This is what the Gemara is talking about. When it talks about this concept of Baishanim, that the Jewish trait is to have busha. But let's just give a bit of introduction to this. We've often talked about this idea. One of the key factors to understanding personal growth is the idea of self-control. Right? Self-control. How does self-control work? Discipline, right? We know this. There's a famous marshmallow experiment. I'm sure many people are familiar with it, about, you know, that kids, that we attract kids who had a better self-control, innate self-control ability than others, they're much more successful in life and so on, right? That's why in terms of educating young children, the best thing you can do for young children is to teach them the art of delayed gratification, self-control, and so on and so forth, because that gives us the ability to make decisions. What is self-control? How does it work? So we know the famous Stephen Covey, One of the Seven Habits, which is actually based on the works of Viktor Frankl, who talked about this idea that the idea to pause. What does that mean? That the pause which happens between stimulus and response, right? So the way our life works is there's a stimulus and there's a response. So meaning someone puts chocolate cake on the table, that's the stimulus. The response is, I have to eat it, right? No. What? Right. So when I grab it right away, in other words, if my impulsive reaction is, I'm just giving an example of chocolate cake, but it's not always bad to eat chocolate cake, by the way. In moderation, right? But I'm saying, if it's unhealthy, right? A cigarette or a substance that's negative, whatever the case is, or anything that we do, the stimulus could be someone said something to me. I got upset, so impulsively I hit back, right? So that's when there's no pause. How do we make decisions and make choices, and how do we increase the level of self-control? We implement the pause between the stimulus and the response, right? Now, why is that so important? On a very basic level, the way we've always talked about it is this, that decisions, impulsive reactions come from the heart, they come from emotion, instinct, impulsivity. Choices that I need to make which are difficult for me, but nevertheless moral, or healthy, or correct, or constructive, that comes from the brain, that comes from thinking, our mind. Our mind gives us the ability to make a choice, right? Now, the mind works slower than emotions do, that's just a fact, right? Our emotional well-being, it's subjective, it's passionate, it's impulsive. Emotions work a lot faster than the brain does. Okay? Therefore, if a stimulus happens and I have a natural emotional response to it, which is my impulsive response, anger, resentment, upsetness, indulgence, whatever the response is, that's there right away. Once I start, it's very hard to backtrack. How do I create self-control? How do I make a decision that it's not good for me? How do I make a decision that it's not good to answer back? How's not good to eat the chocolate cake? How's not good to punch the guy in the face? Whatever the response is going to be. It's not good to be grumpy or upset, whatever the case is. How do I make that? By creating a pause. The pause gives a chance for my brain to kick in. Then to think about it. Is it moral? Is it immoral? Is it right? Is it wrong? Is it beneficial? Is it destructive? Is it harmful? And so on and so forth. And that space gives me then the ability for my brain to allow me to make a choice. I can make the choice. I can step back and not start on the journey of the negative emotional response. Right? That's the basic idea. But what happens in... So that's a critical thing, right? That's a critical thing. That's also got to do with being mindful and being slow and not rushing things and so on and so forth. Right? So it's ability to it's a training to think before we act, to think before we speak, all that kind of stuff. Okay. What happens during that pause? What's going to happen during that pause that's going to stop me from doing what I want to do? What's going to allow me to understand that what I want to do, rather than rationalize it, I override it with something that's stronger? What's going to happen during that time? So one of the things that can happen during that time, and this idea that I'm actually sharing with you is I learned this from Dr. Polkowitz, said in this way, is healthy shame, good shame. What is that? So he says like this, I'll read it to you. He says, shame can be viewed as the midah, the trait that occupies the space. It is the pause that makes us aware whether our actions measure up to our true standards. Right? Now, what does that mean? It means like this. You know that the human being operates on many levels. Okay? So we have, like we talked about many times, the five layers of the soul and so on. So we have our cognitive level, our emotional level, our behavioral level, our subconscious. And then we've got the spark, our inner sense, our inner self, the depth of our soul. The part of us that is really us, but hidden sometimes, right? It's what Viktor Frankl calls is the source of the search and the aspiration to give life meaning. It's basically what Yiddishkeit calls the pintel in the neshama, the essence of the soul that is always good, that is always pure. It's the part of us that actually wants to live a life which is meaningful, purposeful, selfless rather than selfish, live for a higher purpose, live for a higher cause, live positively rather than negatively and so on, or morally rather than immorally. That's who we really are. However, God multi-layered us, right? So who we really are, and that's why we're never defined by our failures. Because we are never our failures, right? Because who we really are is someone that wants to do well. Someone that wants to do the right thing. Someone that wants to live with values. That's the innate person of human being. That's certainly true Jewishly. But it's even, in the last number of decades, they've discovered this not only Jewishly. This was Viktor Frankl's work, although he was Jewish and quite Jewish. But this is his thesis, that a person is born for meaning. And therefore, when a person doesn't seek meaning, they're actually unhappy, right? The only way a person can be happy is to live a life of meaning on some level, right? In Yiddishkeit, obviously, means to follow our moral compass, the Torah, mitzvot, and so on. Ben Adam l'chaviro, between man and man, between man and God, and so on, right? And that's who we really are. So therefore, he says like this. He says, therefore, when we are faced with a stimulus where our initial reaction is to react negatively, what should stop us, what should happen in that pause, is that inner shame. Not to be embarrassed of the world outside of us, but to be embarrassed of ourselves. In other words, is that really me? What I want to do, is that really who I am? Does that match with my true essence? That's busha. Which essentially also means embarrassed before God, but not in a negative way, in a positive way. In other words, God expects more from me. God believes in me more than that. Why does he believe in me more than that? Because he gave me a soul when I woke up this morning and I said, "Modeani." And when I said Mode Ani, I said the famous thing at the end of Mode Ani, I said Rabba Emunatecha. I've shared this with you a number of times. Rabba Emunatecha means great is your faithfulness, but some of the commentaries say it means great is your faith. We talk to God. Great is your faith in me. The fact you gave me another day is because you believe in me. God believes in me. How does he believe in me? Why does he give me another day? Yesterday I messed up so badly. Last week I messed up so badly. Last 10 years I messed up so badly. And he still believes in me. Why? Because he knows that the real me is not what I've been doing. That's just on the outside. That's superficial. Whatever we do is superficial. Doesn't mean we shouldn't take responsibility for it. We do have to take responsibility for it. Absolutely. But it's still not who we really are. It's still superficial. So therefore, the real concept of busha, and that's why the Or HaTzadikim said that busha is the iron gate that separates us and sin. That's exactly why. Because it's that busha, it's that embarrassment, that shame, that good shame, that positive shame that we should implement and think about in that pause. That's what we think about in that pause. That's what the pause is for. To say, hold on a second, I can't do that. It's pastish. I'm embarrassed to do that. It's not befitting. I'm not embarrassed from you or from someone else. I'm embarrassed of my real self. That's not becoming of me to do a thing like that. That's the busha. That's what the Talmud says, that one of the innate properties of being Jewish, therefore, is baishanim. It's not to be impulsive. That's the opposite of, you said meek, but it's a good meek. In other words, it's about not being impulsive. It's about stopping and thinking, is this befitting for me to do or not? That's the key to everything. That's the key to self-control, right? Which is very, very, it's interesting that the word busha means shame, but also it's connected to a different word. You know, in Hebrew, a lot of times words are connected. And an amazing thing, now that we've understood this idea, in the Torah it says, by the golden calf, right? It says that Moshe Rabbeinu was late. That's why they made the golden calf, right? What's the expression that's used? By Yar Ha'am, the nation saw, ki boshesh Moshe. That Moshe was delayed. Busha and boshesh is the same root. So the word busha doesn't only mean shame, it also means delayed. Because that shame comes from its pause. It's the idea of the pause. It'll just stop and say, let me think. Let me delay my response so that I can experience true busha, true embarrassment. Just last week's parasha, 2 weeks parasha ago, sorry. Had a famous idea, right? That Yosef HaTzadik is, even though he was a great person, and he was a tzaddik, but he was tempted by Potiphar's wife, and he was about to sin. That's what it says. Vayit mama, he refused eventually, he overcame. Why did he overcome? So it says, the Chazal tell us, because he saw the form of his father. Dmut yukno shel aviv, he saw the vision of Yaakov in the window, looking at him. And so, his father was miles away, right? His father won't find out. He shouldn't have to worry. What does he care? And one of the commentaries say that it means like this, that he didn't say he saw the vision of his father and was embarrassed to do it because of his father. He saw a vision of his father who wasn't comforted because his father refused to give up on him. Figuratively, symbolically speaking, in other words, a person can be down in the dumps of Egypt in the place which of impurity, but the Yaakov doesn't give up on us. Why? Because we always have that purity. And therefore Yosef experienced that sort of positive shame. When he experienced that positive shame, he was able to overcome and have self-control. So therefore, is regret, guilt, and shame a good thing? It depends when. Right? So if it's obsessive regret and obsessive guilt, out of control guilt, or blaming guilt, it's a bad thing. If it's shame of others, it's a terrible thing. But if regret and guilt is a sense of urgency to feel uncomfortable where we are, to facilitate growth, and we're able to banish it in time, to have it experience it just enough to be motivated but not too much to paralyze us, and shame is about shame from our true inner self which we exercise during the pause, then it's a good thing. Okay, I'm just going to stop there because I need to take the computer upstairs for the lecture. Rabbi Chaitin is going to be giving an interesting lecture about some of the stuff. Oh, that's a whole other thing. Actually, it's part of our davening. Actually, we actually ask God to help us not be embarrassed when we get there. Okay, I'm just going to... Okay, for those that are on Zoom, I'm going to actually end this meeting because I'm going to take the computer somewhere else. But in give it 5-7 minutes, you can come back if you want to say the second lecture. It'll be on this Zoom as well. For those that are here, upstairs in Mizrahi Shul, that's where the lecture is going to be. Rabbi Chayin is going to be given on Jewish concepts that are connected with what we experienced during COVID. Interesting shir. And see you tomorrow. Tomorrow we don't have the shir. Tomorrow there are only 2 shirim, the women's and the men's, on the first hour and then the lecture in the second hour and for the rest of the week. It's my wife's giving the shir. It's in Bina, and it's the women's shir. It's going to be on lessons from the Book of Bereshit. It's a men's shir on the Talmud. Yeah. Thank you. You're welcome.